everyone. Welcome to Wildfowl Podcast number 48. Hope all you duck hunters and goose hunters out there are having a great off season, though the season really is pretty much never ending, it seems, these days. We just got back from a great trip to Alberta chasing snow geese in May. And I got my big buddy, Big Jim McConville, here with me today, my co-host, and a rock star biologist friend of ours, Chris Nicolai. If ever there was a rock star biologist in history of waterfowling, it's him. And he coined a cool term that right before I went on this Alberta trip. He said, "Man, you better." This is a week and a half ago. He said, "You better get up there. They're gonna jump the trees." I'm like, "Jump the trees? What are you talking about?" He goes, "The boreal forest. That's what they call it when they're on their last stop for grain in the central provinces, and their last shot at farm fields, really. And they're starting to pair up in courtship terms." He goes, "And then they leap from there. They got thousands of miles to fly over the boreal forest to the tundra." And I'm like, "What a cool term!" And I couldn't get it out of my head. And that's one of the neat things about Chris Nicolai. And he has been featured in Wildfowl Magazine three different times. He's a biologist for Delta now, but he's had a storied long career chasing ducks. One of my favorite stories ever in Wildfowl was the one where we dubbed him the Indiana Jones of waterfowling by his friend and also a biologist, Joseph Albanese. And in that story, they talked about how Chris has hunted and bagged all but maybe one or two species of North American waterfowl. That's probably, since that story's run, he's probably gotten them all, but he hunts and handles waterfowl about 310 days a year as a biologist. The story was full of planes, terrifying boat incidents, helicopters, net guns. It was just a really neat story. And then again, we featured him as part of a larger feature year before last by Scott Haugen on a deep, deep dive into the Pacific Black Brant and that magical saltwater goose we all love, on all the research him and a huge team of biologists are doing on that. He's going to talk a little bit about that for us today. And then he's on newsstands now in the current issue, the June issue of Wildfowl. An amazing feature, a powerful feature on how to raise a hunter, talking about raising his daughter at a whole different level of waterfowling, from hand carving decoys to hand loading tungsten shells and chasing emperor geese with a very young child. It's a really cool story. Don't miss it. But Christopher, I hear you're no doubt heading back into the field here pretty quick. Thanks for making time for us today.
Yeah, no, it's fun. Good to do a podcast with you.
Where are you headed next?
We are heading to the Washington Brant Foundation fundraiser tomorrow. Big decoy show and hanging out with some good folks out west.
Oh, that's really cool. Yeah. Hey, Jim, you've been fishing your tail off. I've been seeing online. How's your off season going? How have you been able to shake the waterfowl bug?
I have not been able to shake the waterfowl bug. I live real close to Lake Erie. It's only about 12 miles from my house, and the walleye fishing right now is off the charts. And we just ran into some really nice smallmouth. We weren't targeting those, but still seeing ducks buzz around. I got all fired up. I had two pairs of blue-winged teal. And in the fall, when we get the teal, they're not in full plumage, which sort of sucks. I'd love to see one with a silver head or a purple head with a big white crescent moon up on their face. I've only seen that in January down in Louisiana. So some blue-winged teals went by, and they were lit up like neon signs. It was really cool to see them. Tremendous amount of geese skip around the house. I don't know what's going on with the Canada goose, but they're reproducing like mad. We're seeing a lot of goslings. It's exciting because the numbers are outrageous. I don't know where they go in the fall or late winter when we try to ambush them or lure them into our grain fields to shoot a few. They seem to disappear. They miss hang out in the golf courses and city limits all year round, and they've gotten so smart they avoid us. But no, it's been good. Fishing's been great. A lot of birds, been fun. It was awesome to see the blue-winged teal in their full plumage go buzzing by the boat. That really got me jacked up. So things are good in Macombo land.
Now that's great. You see in the wetlands, are they wet there in Ohio? Is it looking good?
It is looking good. I don't know where we're at on waterfall or rainfall, excuse me, but we've been wet for a while, and there's rain in the forecast coming up. It seems like I would say it's more of a normal year than an off year, We did not get the cold, snowy weather that we normally get in December, January, which really suits our type of hunting. We love to get into 80 to 200 acre fields that are got about 2-3 inches of snow on them. So we can hide in white suits and sit out in the decoys, and the goose decoys are just so awesome these days. They're like lifelike. And, we run silhouettes and full bodies depending on how many people we're going. And on the snow, they stick out like we're open sign at a sports bar in downtown Cleveland. They can see you forever.
You give me goosebumps again, but that's really cool. You know, I've actually always wanted to eat one of those duck-sized baby geese. I know they're beautiful and it's cool to see them, but I always wondered what they taste when they're about 2 pounds instead of 8 or 10. But I'm off into weeds. Let's talk about the Indiana Jones of waterfowling, Chris Nicolai. I can't wait to tell the story about how you got your start. I read it in that story about how you snapped. You were off in college. I think you were going to study aviation or something like that. And you walked allegedly into a room full of bird wings, and then you just lost it. You snapped and you never looked back. You became a full-on career quackhead. So could you tell us a little bit about that moment and how it happened for you and where?
Yeah, no, that's fine. I actually talked about it. Yeah, I just came back from two lectures at Bismarck High School here talking about careers and what I do and that there's options. Because, yeah, exactly like you said, I didn't even know you could be a wildlife biologist. You know, I was born in 73 and watched Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom and grew up with Marty Stauffer and stuff like that. And that's what I knew about wildlife biology. And, you know, even then you could tell this looked more recreational than anything. So, yeah, I had no clue. And, yeah, I was going to school in Northeast Minnesota in a community college, all signed up for an aviation major. And I think it was my third week in there. Two things happened. One, well, first I was walking and I'm a glutton for ice cream and stopped at an ice cream shop and was eating a sundae or something and heard two guys doing the same thing talking next to me. And they're talking all about deer and wolves and telemetry and breaking leg bones open to look at the marrow and all this. And, yeah, talked with them for maybe 20, 30 minutes. Like, really, you guys do this for a job? Oh, yeah, we do this. And ended up being one of probably the most famous wolf biologists ever. And, yeah, the next day I was walking around that school and walked by their biggest classroom. And, yeah, there's probably 100, 150 duck wings in there, and I'd already met the teacher for that class and grabbed him afterwards. I'm like, hey, what's that class all about? And he's like, oh, we're doing duck wing ID. And yeah, I knew all the scientific names for ducks when I was like 8. You know, I had no problem identifying stuff. I'm like, geez, that sounds pretty cool. So
you were a quackhead right way before that aha moment.
Yeah, my family hunted a little bit. I showed up like after the heyday of the big duck killing days for my dad and grandfather, but they were still talking about it. But yeah, I had a friend in elementary school that his family was avid. And yeah, pretty much every time they'd come home, I'd get to go over and see all these ducks for the first time. You know, first time I ever seen a wood duck in my hands or a gadwall. He was like, yeah, that's pretty cool. So yeah, no, I've always been into it. And, you know, family hunted, but pretty much my uncle and I were self-taught. We were only 10 years apart, so more like brothers. And I think we were jump shooting for a good 4 or 5 years before we figured, hey, we should buy one of those decoys and see if they help. And yeah, things changed very fast after that.
Oh, that's cool.
Where, yeah, well, we didn't have anyone to show us how to get permission or how to set decoys or how to call or nothing. I mean, we were completely self-taught.
Where were you growing up?
The very beginning, I was in just out of St. Louis, Missouri, right where the Illinois, Missouri, and Mississippi come together. So pretty famous area. And then we moved to Minnesota when I was 13, and that completely changed my outlook of wild places and wildlife. Because, yeah, Minnesota in the late 80s was teeming with waterfowl. Unlike Missouri at the time, you know, Missouri's more staging wintering kind of spot. So it was pretty cool to get somewhere where raise a lot of birds and have a lot of upland birds, public lands, stuff like that.
Except you can't tell the mosquitoes from the teal up there, but I suppose that's the same. That's the same in Missouri, right?
Same. We were in Louisiana 6 weeks ago, and oh my God, they were bad there already. So yeah, everyone's got mosquitoes. Even Nevada in the desert, when I lived out there, he did not want to be around at sunset and sunrise.
Yeah, they're weird. They're unpredictable. Like where I live, there are none. But you venture five miles down to the river, and you know you can get flown away with only in certain years. And I got caught in a snowstorm in Colorado, 11,000 feet on the 4th of July 1 year. And that place came alive with mosquitoes at that elevation. It blew my mind. You couldn't get out of your car. We had to leave. But are the waterfowl pretty reliant upon, in this area I live, it's really arid. And there'll be almost no bugs in a dry year like the last few we've had. Then we have an El Nino year like this, and it's going to explode with grasshoppers. And I noticed the upland birds, the turkeys, do noticeably better, the blue quail, everything else. Is that an important thing to waterfowl too?
For ducks, the inverts are huge. You know, geese, not so much. Geese are pretty much herbivores their whole life. But yeah, almost all the ducks, all the ducks and all the upland birds, even if they are vegetarians later in life, they start off as carnivores and focusing on all those bugs.
Oh, cool. I have seen them snapping at them here and there. I didn't know how integral that is. So you walked into this room full of wings and decided you could be a biologist. And did you break that to your parents that you were going to go be a duck research guy and not an aeronautical engineer or something? How did they take the news?
Yeah, no, they were fine. I mean, I applied. I had cool ecology classes in high school too, so I was really surprised we never learned it there. You know, I remember I had an awesome wildlife teacher in high school, and we had a lot of fun fixing duck wings and everything then. But yeah, no idea about job. But yeah, I could have gone to any college I wanted to with scores, and pretty much chose a community college, you know, up in Northeast Minnesota, just because hunting and fishing was the best I knew at that time. And that made my decision. So they're already let down that I wasn't going to some hoity-toity place, but no one could complain with the tuition bill. So it was a good trade-off. And yeah, they always wondered. You know, my dad was pretty good about coming to a lot of my field sites once I started doing technician and graduate work and realized, you know, it was legit. But you know, he's probably looking at the top end salaries and wondering, but he could tell I already had pretty low standards for quality of living.
Jim got recruited as a standout football player at Ohio State. I did not. So I chose like you. I went where the Snake River for steelhead fishing, chucker hunting, pheasant hunting, Washington State. Entirely chose where I went to college based on hunting opportunities and getting out of Seattle rain as well. Your story starts the Indiana Jones story. The Indiana Jones of waterfowling story starts with you being stuck offshore in the YK Delta in Alaska with a dying battery and a bunch of stranded biologists and just every waterfowler's nightmare. I'm sure Jim can relate to that. He's always fishing on the Great Lakes. But tell us a little bit about that misadventure and a few more of your more exciting ones. If you've ever been in a small plane crash or anything like that in all your research. Jesus.
Yeah, and if I could, let me give a lot of credit to all the cool folks I've got to work with over the years. You know, it's not like I went out and did this on my own. It was, and sometimes I was, but at the beginning, you know, I got trained by a lot of awesome folks that most of them are retiring now, feeling kind of old these days. But yeah, that outboard story is actually just me and my wife. We had already hauled everybody into town. Everyone had already left. And we had one more run back to camp, just last minute little things, you know, half a skiff load. I think we were in a 16-foot Lund with like a 30 horse on it. And end of the year, everyone's, you know, handing away gas. Hey, this needs to get burned. Take this, take that. So we just grabbed, you know, some half empty jerry cans and figured we'd make it back to town. And sure enough, one ran out and we're pretty good at, you know, you feel it start sputtering and everything. You could disconnect that one and hook it up to the next one without even slowing down, you know. And it went for about another 300 yards and started sputtering bad. And yeah, we were right. It's a lot of coastal sloughs out there. So you'll go out one to the coast, run up the coast a couple miles, and then enter another one. And it goes up and hits another fork and back and forth, inland, out to the coast, up another slough. And yeah, we're out in the open running up to this other slough when this happened. And oof, you know, engine died. Look at the gas, and you can clearly see, you know, two layers in the tank, one water, one gas.
Yikes.
Which ain't good. And, you know, it's the only jug of gas we got left. And we can see the village probably 6 miles away as the crow flies, 20 miles through all the back and forths up the slough, and, you know, an outgoing tide. So now we're getting pushed the wrong way too. And yeah, just sat there, had patience, poured it off. Got the water out of the fuel line, started it up, beelined it, I don't know, 12 miles to get to the North American shore, and let everything settle a little bit longer, separated it all out, poured it off, got it going, made it into the village about, I think our plane was actually landing. And, you know, this is the last plane for 2 days or so. And one of my local friends, native guy there, grabbed my boat, told us to get out of there. He put everything away for us, and we made our flight.
You're so casual about it, but the truth is, well, we could see the lights of the village over there. Yeah, but how far could you swim in that water? What was it, 40-degree water typically?
Yeah, 40. And yeah, like we had an anchor with a rope, and it wouldn't hold. You know, it's too deep. Yeah, it's all mud, you know, very packed coastal YK Delta volcanic mud. And yeah, we there is no way to stop me. Yeah.
Yeah. You were
that about, a long swim.
You were going to become as one with the anchor.
Oh yeah. We're moving to Kamchatka or Japan, depending on which way the currents went.
Oh Jesus.
Jim, I bet you can relate to that. A scary boat story or two.
Oh yeah. I was my graduation gift. When I got out of school, I bugged my dad for several years, and the following fall, he took me up to the Hudson James Bay region, and we went goose hunting, and we were running in 22-foot freight canoes that the Creed Indians had on their place with 70 horse outboards. And the guy goes, pack a lunch tomorrow. And I'm like, what the hell, pack a lunch? He goes, we're going for a boat ride. And I said, oh wow, this is, you know, interesting. And so we get down and load all the gear up and everything, and don't have many decoys. We had some little wind socks and stuff, things that were incidental. And when we started to shoot snows and blues, we'd use them as decoys. They just, you know, take a coat hanger and prop their head up and have a rubber band or two to put their broken wings, slide the rubber band over the body, and here we go. So we get in the boat, we go out the river channel, and I guess we're in James Bay. I don't know. We're somewhere where I can't see the other side. We're driving. And all of a sudden, you know, it starts to sputter, like Chris said, and he hooks onto another tank. Boom. So we drive. It was probably 2 hours, maybe an hour and 45 minutes, but it seemed like 3 days. We get down to where we're supposed to hunt, and we have a great hunt, and we come back to the boat, and the tide goes out. And we have to wait on the tide. We get back in the boat, and we're driving back to camp, you know, just probably an hour or light left, and the guy makes a quick turn in the open water, and I can't figure out what the hell he's doing, and it's bitter cold. It's September. The water's colder than shit. The air's cold. We miss a boulder the size of a van with the boat going maybe 25 miles an hour. And then I thought, oh, shit, he's going to run a rock over. We're all going in the drink. Well, he didn't run a rock over, and we got back, and we shot a lot of birds. But that whole experience, I mean, there's no one around. There's no aircraft flying overhead, no conduit trails of commercial jets or anything. You're out there where baby Jesus lost his slippers. That's all I can say at that point. And you're not going to hail anybody. You're not going to shoot a flare, and you're not going to take your red flag with the black square in the middle and, you know, your stress and wave it in the air for another boater. So that was a surreal thing, but I have several more, but I want to hear more about Chris. I'm going to talk to Chris about some of his decoys and some of the things he has accomplished. My decoys, I love to death. They do work, but my kids and friends say they look like a fourth grade art project. So I guess I got to improve on my ability to make a better decoy, Chris.
Let's talk about that, Chris, and then lead us through some of your major projects. Like, what project were you working on with that crazy boat misadventure? And then through the work projects you're most proud of. But yeah, let's talk about your handmade decoys too.
Yeah, I'll follow up on those. Just a quick one there. You know, for me, it's I've only been in a couple places where you can't pick up any radio stations. That's an eye opener. I mean, there's one thing. I've probably spent 6-7 years of my life living in tents in the middle of nowhere, you know, usually in the middle of goose colonies. And I can still pick up radio stations till you get to the high Arctic and there's nothing. And you'll see contrails going over and satellite. Well, you won't even see satellites because it doesn't get dark. And there's pretty much no evidence of humans other than garbage in the rack lines, but that's about it. But nope, those remote situations are fun.
What's it like living in the middle of a goose colony? That caught my imagination.
It's noisy all the time. Yep. It's pretty fun though. I mean, you get to, and you're just listening to birds 24/7. You know, we got pintails and speck eiders nesting underneath your tent flies. You know, pintails actually snore while they're sleeping or
what?
You know, it's interesting, you know, when you have these camps and they're all in these sedges and grasses, and just walking every day from the main tent to your tent, you know, you're actually breaking all these little plants. You know, it's almost like something snipped them and ate them. And so it morphs into all these cool high nitrogen plants. And, you know, the geese just clue in on it because they don't want to eat that rough stuff. They want to eat all the new shoots. So you just walk in and everyone's in their tent sleeping. They come into our camp every night when we're all snoring away. And when you wake up, you know, there's many dozens of families feeding on all these trails, you know, eating all the brand new shoots, just because every time you walk on it, you're breaking it and, you know, it's regrowing. So that's all pretty cool. Yeah, you're sleeping, you know, your tents are the tallest things around. So all the goofy Dunlin and Western sandpipers use your tent to display on, you know, and they always wake you up. You hear their little wing and then
like a drumming effect. Yeah.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, they're pretty much up there displaying, and you kind of just get used to just sleeping all the time and just tapping the wall of your tent just to shoo them away. And, you know, every now and then you'll get one, and, you know, it sounds the same. But in hindsight, when it's all over, it's like, yeah, that was a lot louder. But, yeah, you know, you hear the and then foop, 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 and then you know, it's a willow ptarmigan sitting right on top, and it's like, whoa. That one, that's a lot more exciting than a Dunlin. So you let those guys go and, you know, and then you're listening to that and all of a sudden a sandhill crane flies by your tent at probably 20 feet and calls, and it's, you know, louder than you'd ever think a sandhill crane could be. So it was pretty cool. But then we had other years. I remember it was 01, it was a complete reproductive bust and it was silent out there. Every egg got eaten that year, even Savannah sparrows, redneck phalaropes, and everything was gone. And it was, you couldn't even hear a bird other than the odd gull.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but why? How come they all got eaten?
Yeah, it was the year before was an enormous, one of the biggest, I think, redback vole explosion years. And the Arctic foxes reproduced like rabbits. And the next year, and we're setting up camp, and you'd see 20, 30 Arctic foxes every day, where some years you wouldn't even see an Arctic fox the entire summer. But yeah, that year, all the stars aligned and complete destruction.
That is a trip. I always wondered what it would be like to be a biologist up there living among the half-tamed geese and to see a predator come and just wreaking havoc. It would fire up those protective. Cool. It'd fire up those protective instincts. You know, you'd want to do something about it, but you can't, right?
And it's interesting. You know, I've definitely worked in colonies with long histories, like where I did all my graduate work or most of my graduate work. You know, people have been working there since the 40s, and then you go to other places where you're just visiting for 3 or 4 days, doing some banding, and they're very different. You know, you realize these guys are used to us walking around and not doing much, and then these guys aren't, you know, they're crazy during nesting. you know, the tame birds, you can walk right up to them. I mean, sometimes you need to put a radio on them. You can just grab them barehanded, where another bird, you got to run a remote control trap and get off the horizon, or banding. You can herd them like sheep in one spot, and other places they're running for a mile, and you better have it ready.
Hey, Chris, I have a quick question for you. What's the average total amount of bands that are put on ducks and geese? I know you all birds get banded, but the ducks of North America and the geese, how many bands do you guys try to, like, bird-wise per year? Like, what's your number? What's your goal? Like, what do you try to get banded?
Yeah, I mean, you got to – if you're talking about goals, that's a whole different question than just how many get banded. So goals, you know, those are all – identified in management plan. So it's like, okay, this is a bird, we're going to manage it with banding data. And that's actually pretty rare. A lot of the geese are like that. And then what, you got three populations of mallards, eastern wood ducks.
Back up. Whoa. Three populations. What are the three populations?
Okay, so mallards, you've got the western mallard model, you got the eastern mallard model, and then you got the mid-continent, you know, Mississippi / central flyway. So there's only a handful of duck populations we manage with banding data, and it's probably those three mallards, eastern wood ducks, and black ducks. I bet you're the only ducks we manage with banding data. You know, everything else, there's two schools of thoughts. Either you don't band it because there's not a management plan, or like several of us, we band every bird we catch because there's a lot of really neat examples. You know, some of the recent liberalizations of blue-winged teal is all from, you know, people just banning everything they caught. Some of the stuff we're learning about redheads, you know, all these non-target birds, as long as you ban them, there's still data to accumulate. And, you know, you give it enough time, you learn all this new analytical techniques, and we can make magic out of these non-priority bandings. But, you know, like geese, we've been switching over the last decade. People have realized it's really hard to count geese. You know, we give all three of us a different photograph, and or we're all sitting in the plane and we all throw a number out at the same time, and they vary immensely. I mean, some of us could have half the number of the other, even though we're looking at the same group. So a lot of the geese, not all of them, they've switched to using, you know, this Lincoln estimator, using banding data. So a lot of the goose populations have goose goals. So yeah, so for those populations, I'd have to guess we're not banding as many mallards as we used to. We just don't have as many folks that are really good at it. Like up through the 90s and early 2000s, we had a lot of just insane Fish and Wildlife Service pilot biologists that were super good at banding ducks. And I think ducks are just easier to catch back then, too, because we still got good folks, but we just can't catch as many mallards as we used to. And, you know, we're probably doing between everybody for mallards, maybe 50,000 mallards in the best of years currently. You know, and you get some of the other bandings to add to that, and that helps. And then geese, you know, not thinking about temperate breeding geese, I don't know a whole lot about, you know, and everybody, every state bans their local geese different. But for the Arctic stuff, boy, I'd be willing to bet, you know, just off the cuff, if we did 30,000 geese, Arctic geese a year, I'd be impressed.
Hey, Chris, do any of those geese get neck collars, those PVC pipe neck collars or plastic collars?
No, I mean, you still see some popping up every now and then for some small project for some need. But no, for the most part, we're staying away from those. I mean, you'll still see, we've got these really cool GSM, you know, cell phone radios, but they're mostly, you know, some different color of plastic covered with solar panels. So very different than what you saw from all that 90s and 2000, early 2000s work, when we were trying to really delineate these populations a little bit more. But yeah, all our data shows, one, it impacts their natural mortality, you know, non-hunting mortality quite a bit. But second, it does get influenced by harvest rate just because they get targeted. So yeah, no point in collecting biased data. So a lot of us have just gotten away from those type of auxiliary markers, we call them.
That's interesting. I was wanted to ask you how banding itself is changing. Shameless plug here. We got a huge story on banding called Precious Metals by Lynn Burkhead in the same issue of Wildfowl, the June issue that the feature on Chris and his daughter, How to Raise a Hunter, is in. But he alludes to the fact that they're trying to find more discrete methods of banding because hunters have kind of gotten a little crazy, a little band crazy. We've always been a little bit that way, but it's become even more so. And can you tell us anything about trying to reduce birds as targets, everyone going to dark colored bands and getting rid of the ostentatious neck collars? Is that a rumor in the duck blind, or is that real?
No, I think collars, any contemporary bander would probably have no interest in using them anymore. I mean, we've known about that for a long time, you know, like I said, let alone getting targeted, but they just don't behave normal. And, you know, their survival decreases just when you put a collar on them versus a metal band. And so we know there's something, you know, they're spending too much time rather than eating. There could be some icing effects, you know, anything like that. And then, yeah, there's been the black tarsal bands on, you know, some of these temperate breeding geese. You know, Utah's started that about 10 years ago. And what is it, like some of the lower Mississippi flyway states are starting to do it now. And, you know, we actually looked at it with black brant a few years ago. We published a paper on it, you know, band targeting and how it impacts demographic rates and everything. And, you know, it's not a clear signal, but it's definitely a signal there. And, you know, just biasing things. And yeah, it's like, I'm aware of, you know, there's decoy companies advertising, you'll get more bands with our decoys and stuff like that. And outfitters, you know, advertising how many bands they get. It's really interesting. You know, it's okay. For example, we had a full strut turkey 40 yards last Wednesday, me and my daughter, and she needed a tag. And she's like, I don't want to shoot that one. You know, so we let him walk on by about 40 yards, and 5 minutes later, a different gobbler came in. You know, I don't get it, you know, but that's just the, you know, I'm biased biologist there. You know, bands are one thing, but like these collars we get are just phenomenal. I mean, every day I'm so happy to be able to look at these and where they're at and what they're doing, and it adds up and adds up. And when I have a goose with its fourth year, you know, fourth migration round trip, and someone shoots it and says it's the highlight pinnacle of his waterfowling career, it's like, dude, you just ended the story of this goose. You know, is it going to go back? I mean, we've had a couple snow geese that would start in California and go to Wrangell and then go to Arkansas and then go to Banks and then go back to Arkansas and go to Baffin and then end up back in California. It's like, oh my gosh, you know, we could have never predicted this. And, you know, it costs us so much money, mainly just to catch the bird. You know, the radios aren't that bad anymore, but, you know, we spend all this time and money to get a radio device on, and then someone shoots it. And, you know, I'm sad. I get that the hunter's excited, but I don't get how it's the pinnacle of a waterfowling, quote unquote, career, you know? To me, it's like, no, it's the end of a pretty dang cool story, man. I was waiting for next year's episode.
Yeah, with a band, it's a biologist, you know, you need hunters to harvest them to get the valuable information, but with that telemetry type stuff, right, I feel pretty bad if I dumped one that had only been strapped on, you know, a couple months earlier, all that effort.
Well, I've explained it to a few folks. I mean, I've had some pretty heated arguments. You know, I've been involved with a lot of these heated arguments about taking people banding and, you know, bias, you know, people targeting bands and stuff like that. And, you know, I have some really heated ones. And, you know, some people are like, well, I donate this, I donate that, I do all this. And it's like, you know how much it costs us to go to the Arctic for fuel, for, you know, food, for equipment, to band birds, to get someone to shoot a legit recovery, you know, because say Brant, for example, if we band 100, we might get 2 back this year. You know, so even though we banded 3,000 that year, we're probably only going to get 60 that year, you know, do our statistics with. And when you take that entire sum of fuel and salaries and permits and bands and radios and divide it by how many we actually get from hunters, those each one becomes a pretty good chunk of money, you know, usually bigger than the average hunter's donation. So yeah, it's a lot of work and a lot of fundraising to get those bands out there, and to have some of them discounted by selective targeting is disappointing, but whole different story there.
Yeah, I didn't want to get into bands too much today, but it is fascinating to me in this day and age, of this digital day and age, that such a primitive technology, a soft piece of aluminum strap literally to a bird's leg with numbers on it, it's unchanged for, you know, 60 years. I don't know when banding started, but that it's still effective and works. It's really neat. But let's talk a little bit more about the projects that you're most proud of, that some of your wild adventures where waterfowling has led you.
Yeah, well, you know, I did a lot of work on the YK Delta. All my master's and, well, before graduate school as a technician, and my master's and PhD and a bunch of follow-up stuff after that with Science Center folks from Anchorage. And that was all fun, you know. And then I lived in Nevada for 18, 19 years, you know, the driest state in the union, actually probably among the bottom four for duck stamp sales. And no one thinks of it as a place. And yeah, ended up stumbling into a really cool situation with wood ducks that don't migrate a whole bunch. And we did a lot of neat stuff there. You know, we actually realized quickly that these don't migrate a whole lot. So we always referred to it as studying ducks in a fishbowl. And it was really cool. We actually convinced, you know, worked together with the State Wildlife Commission, and we actually did an experiment where some years we dropped the bag limit. You know, Pacific Flyway's 107-day season with a 7-bird wood duck bag, unlike the Eastern 3 flyways. So we were able to drop the bag limit. We didn't close it because we didn't want anyone to get tickets for accidents, but dropped it down to 1 and under-harvested them, you know, quote-unquote under-harvested them for 2 years, and then went back to 7-bird bags and encouraged people to over-harvest them. And then we had a whole lot of normal years to compare to, and regardless of the harvest treatment, we actually had a pretty stable population. It was more driven by winter snowpack and spring runoff than harvest reg. So that was pretty cool, because it's been nearly impossible to do harvest experiments on waterfowl. You know, we're talking about doing it here soon, but, you know, no one wants to shut down a season just for an experiment, you know. Yeah, and getting to go, like, spring break we did about 5 weeks ago. First time the family's loaded up and flown across the country, and we went down and banded ducks. Some friends in Louisiana, so the whole family. See, my oldest daughter and wife now can say they've seen every North American waterfowl, so that was pretty cool. They got to see fulvis and black bellies and mottleds. Yeah, the little kid still needs to see specks and kings. But yeah, no, it's just fun. Being in this career has been so cool. One, you meet just some of the world's best people, and waterfowlers are just, I enjoy 98% of them. And, you know, you get to go to cool places and just get to see cool birds, you know. It's been a lot of fun. So, yeah, there's been a lot of trips, lots and lots of them that I look at pictures all the time. Good memories.
One cool illusion in that story talked about how you probably learned it. Independence, it taught you to be self-reliant, something a lot of kids these days do not have the opportunity to do, being rushed back and forth to soccer. And you were dropped off in a canoe in the Boundary Waters for, what, a month at a time by your parents, and said, hope to see you again. If we don't, at least we know you died happy. Later, son.
Yeah, no, again, uncles and relatives. Yeah. Back when I was getting into wilderness stuff, it was pretty cool. They trusted us. I mean, they knew we'd come back. We'd always catch fish. We didn't always catch fish. Sometimes we lived on berries and other things, crawfish, but yeah, no one ever had any worries about that. That was good fun. And yeah, I couldn't wait to get a car. But yeah, it's interesting. You know, you grow up, and we were definitely late parents. We didn't have our first kid till we were 34 or so. And, you know, it's definitely interesting seeing different age parents, you know, and how everyone parents differently. And just how a lot of people don't parent the same as our parents did. You know, you always see these memes of the kids that were survived the 70s and 80s, you know, and honestly, it is different. I've gotten a lot of grief from bosses even. Can't believe that I let my kids handle firearms or, you know, ride 2 miles to go to a pizza joint. And it's like, really, you know, there's always been odd stories. And yeah, some things are very severe, but, you know, I think you just train them and tell them weird things happen and keep your eyes out and, you know, knock on wood so far. Kids are doing good. You know, I was really proud last week. Both my kids, I was off traveling somewhere, maybe Minnesota. No, I was shooting snow geese. I took my old dog for a retirement hunt, and yeah, they needed to get turkeys. So they actually went turkey hunting all by themselves. I was blown away and very proud. And, you know, I don't know any other kids that don't live on, you know, live extremely rural that go out and do that. I was very proud of that. Yeah, I totally trust my kids. That's yeah, they're awesome. Both girls too.
That's awesome. I've had independence as a kid. I was a self-made 11-year-old commercial catfish fisherman in Florida back before catfish farms, catching big cats and, you know, cutting gators off my marginally legal limb lines with live bait on them and all this stuff. And my wife throws it in my face all the time when I'm too protective of our kids, you know, that I don't want to let them go half mile down the street on a bicycle. I had two daughters first, so I am overprotective. And I'm like, wow, what am I going to say? I remember the stuff I did, how I always had a double barrel 12 gauge in the boat when I was 11. And I need to back off and let them grow, right, Jim?
Yeah, yep. No, you know, the world's a funny place. And I think it's great when you have a family and you can do the introductions and then that your son or daughter picks up and goes for it. And I think, you know, I think you just get a well-rounded individual when they become adults. I think it's a great experience. Before we run out of time, Chris, I want to pick your brain on painting some decoys. Do you do like a full body carving? Do you carve them out of wood? Do you do silhouettes? Do you, you know, walk me through some of your decoys, because I've tried to make decoys the majority of my adult life. And it just becomes a laughing point when we're in the field. Really quick, I did a goose rig in 1991. We shot pictures of geese in a golf course, and we took several poses. And we had them, the film got developed, and we took them to Kinko's, and we turned them into overheads. And I actually made the decoys about 400% larger than anatomically what a goose would be. And then we painted them. And when you set them out in the field and got back 100 yards, they looked like real geese, even though they were like Andre the Giant. So that was one of my projects I did. So give me some decoy tips and what you're doing, how you do it, and what makes a good decoy. I know carving them, the bill carries the head carries the body, but the most crucial thing is the paint job. You could have an unbelievable carving, paint it crappy, and you have a crappy decoy.
Oh, yeah. No, and I started in the 80s just because I thought commercial decoys sucked. You know, you got three different bodies painted 10 different species, you know,
right?
And so I got into that and been developing ever since. You know, all those years on the YK Delta, you could tell which tent was mine because there were wood chips all outside my tent door. Yeah, pretty much all my canvas back and redhead rig were all carved out there. But yeah, I mean, I'm not the world's best carver at all. I've been told by probably the best carver this year. You know, I've got a lot of bad habits, but whatever, I learned them myself. But it's fun. It's another good community of folks. And yeah, we're pretty much to the point now we're harvesting our own lumber. Living out west, we had ample access to massive old growth redwood and sugar pine as well, you know, dead and down stuff. And we're milling it with Alaskan mills, and wood dries pretty quick in the Intermountain West. You know, I could get stuff from 60% moisture down to 5-6 in about 8 months, which is pretty cool, and moved a lot of it here. And yeah, pretty much do a lot of floaters. I'll make silhouettes. You know, I really like silhouettes for geese in particular. You know, we've made a zillion Brant silhouettes and Emperor silhouettes. Actually, right behind me, you can see in the office, there's part of my prairie chicken silhouette rig, but I won't talk too much about that one. We can keep that a good secret. But yeah, no, and like you said, well, you got to have the shape right. You know, if someone hands you a decoy that's not even sealed yet and you can't tell what species it is, you got some room for growth. And someone hands you a carved, unpainted decoy, hopefully it's screaming what it is, you know, not necessarily to sex, but to species. And then, you know, the paint job can just make it or break it. And that's where I've been struggling the most lately, or changing the most. There's been, you know, social media and everything. Oh, look at that. There we go. I would say green wing teal.
Bingo. 100% correct. That was carved by a world champion. And the half the head was done by his buddy. And the other half, you could see burnt in the feathering right there. So I have never finished this. It's set up. It's in my office. I'm in love with this thing. I'd love to get maybe a guy that could really paint. I mean, I don't know if you guys could pick this up on the actual camera, but
we're not always running video. So for the listener, Jim just held up a like half finished, beautiful handmade decoy. And yeah. Chris was like, oh yeah, wow. Green wing teal. And it has no paint, but he knew right away what it was.
Yeah. So, that's when you know your carvings are getting good. And yeah, it's a lot of fun. Now pretty much, I don't know, all those old forum days, you know, my signature line was semi-autos and plastic decoys are sacrilegious for divers and Brandt. So, yeah, gotta have fun. Life's too short to hunt over ugly decoys.
Right. I want to put a request in. I want to get a decoy from you. If I have to buy one, trade, or rent Skip out for a week, he can come up to the banding grounds and band for 5 days, and that'll be my payment for a decoy from you.
Tell me a little bit about carving with kids, Chris. I know you had your daughter involved. Didn't she shoot an emperor over emperor? I didn't want the listeners to miss that either, that you said emperor goose decoy that y'all worked on together, or was that an eider?
No, I can actually, I'm showing a decoy that my daughter made of her emperor goose that she shot. So yeah, that one's hers. I've got all my rigs sitting right back here too. So yeah, she made hers. I made mine. Well, I made 8 of them. I've got them all back here, but yeah, it's been fun. It was nice living out west. There's a lot of carvers out west. North Dakota, right now, I'm only aware of one other carver, and I already hunt with him. But out west, it was really cool. You know, it was Pacific Flyway Decoy Association out there, and my kids would show up every year, and they were always getting great donations of, you know, someone that recently passed away, tools and stuff like that. And other folks would say, hey, you know, we can... For, you know, because kids' power tools are kind of scary and it takes a lot of work to use power tools, but they had some really cool drum sanders and stuff like that that we could go use. And yeah, it's all been good. They've made a lot of decoys. Like, here's, you know, just showing more. Like, here's one of my other kids. She made this wood duck all by herself.
That's awesome.
That's amazing.
It mostly worked.
You better not give your address out. Jim's going to break in that office. I can tell he's getting goosebumps over there.
I am. Oh, I mean, I have about 90 wooden decoys. Some are cork that are in my office that I've started collecting at the age of 15. My dad would take me to a decoy show in February or March, and he'd allow me to buy one or two. And when we were kids, you could buy gunning decoys right at the show out of a old peck basket off a farm or whatever, and burlap bags. And they wanted $20 or $15, and now you go to the shows and them damn things are $75 to $100. You know, it's hard to find the inexpensive gunning decoys. I'm not looking for a world carver. I just like the fact that the decoy has its own story. I have 5 Drake Golden Eyes that were carved in the Great Lakes, and some of them have shot in them, and the shot in the bird are lead shots, so they're from the 70s. So it's pretty wild, you know.
Yeah, but no, that's my way to relax at night. Yeah, it's pretty cool. It started, I think that was about 2002 at one of our duck conferences. It was the 3rd duck conference. We started a new award for one of my early mentors that passed away. And they're like, hey, you know, for the award, why don't you carve a decoy? And my decoys were okay back then. And it got started. And that's probably 80% of my decoys go to all these retirement and award type stuff for biologists. And recently I'm building a new shop here soon, and I want to start gathering all these photographs. And I think I'm up to like 140 decoys that have gone to these awards for all these famous biologists over the years. It's been extremely rewarding. So it's fun. You know, everyone, it's like, okay, here's the decoy, but you got to give me a picture of the guy holding it and or the person holding it and hanging in my shop. It's, yeah, I really enjoy the decoys. Maybe I'll have something to do when I retire.
I was going to ask you that, you know, how much more time do we get you active out in the field, living in a tent, throwing wood chips at Arctic foxes? How much longer for you?
Oh, I wish. That's one of the disappointments of getting older and climbing ladders and stuff. You don't get to do that stuff as much as you'd like. And I'd still, and even hanging out with my good friends and everything, I'm about the last one that still really appreciates sleeping on a Therm-a-Rest on the ground. You know, I went over for Minnesota's fishing opener this last weekend, and that was one of my highlights, was three nights in a tent, you know. But
that's from your Boundary Waters days as a kid. It takes you back, right?
That's right where I was too. So it was good fun. But yeah, I'd love to be out there running these camps. But at the same time, you know, I got kids that I like to do kids stuff with. I've got a old dog that's probably not going to make it to the fall. So this is a good summer to not really get too far from home, you know. Next summer, maybe next summer I'll make some big crazy plans with my biologist co-workers.
Jim and I are never going to retire. What are you going to do when you finally have all that time on your hands? What does a biologist with such a deep passion for what he does do when he retires?
I don't know. I think I'm just going to wander off and live in some crazy little shack where it gets cold, but maybe doesn't freeze. I really miss being in the Intermountain West where I could see ducks 365 days a year. And, you know, I grew up in northern Minnesota. Here in North Dakota, I lived in Fairbanks, and these severe winters are, this last winter, I had some pretty severe cabin fever.
Yeah, we wanted that moisture, but it was a crusher for sure.
Hey, Chris, I have a quick question because you've been all over the place. What has been the most spectacular sight of wild ducks at one given point in your career where you were in a boat, you're in a car, wherever you're at, you look up and literally the sky is blackened or the horizon is peppered like mosquitoes, but they're ducks.
What's hands down, 2019, right before, the week before my interview at Delta here, I was up in Barrow, banning snow geese with a really good friend of mine putting radios out. And I actually got to borrow his car, drive out on the Barrow spit with a mug of coffee, and sat there and watched tens of thousands of Pacific and King Eiders flying over the famous Point Barrow. I mean, that was cool. That's something I read about. I can remember reading old Courtright books, you know, published in the 70s, highlighting, you know, the biggest eider migration known to man. Yeah, it was pretty cool. I got pictures of that somewhere too.
Yeah, we'd like to see those. That was a great question and quite a meant of visual image to imagine. I didn't know they ever congregated with those kind of numbers. Are those species
just a crazy spot?
Those species doing okay overall?
Kings and Pacifics?
Yeah.
No, they're probably, there's a lot of Beringia birds that plummeted in the 70s into the 80s and Pacifics, Specs, Stellar. Well, Stellars is before that. But, you know, just in the 70s to 80s, Kings and Pacifics probably dropped by half, if not more locally. And, you know, specs on the YK Delta. I mean, there's some biologists still alive, like old Chris Dow. You know, he did his master's on specs in the 70s.
I got to interrupt one second. You're talking about spectacled eiders, not speckled belly geese for the listeners, right?
Oh, yes. Yep. You just picked up on one of my biggest pet peeves. Yeah. Speck is an eider, not a goose. But yes, spectacled eiders. But yeah, I mean, it's pretty cool. I mean, they were probably they were the most abundant duck on the coastal YK Delta through the 70s. And then, you know, things just plummeted for them to get listed in, what, 93. And then, you know, there's some old accounts from like 1910 that Stellars were the most abundant duck on the YK Delta. And all those years I worked out there, I probably saw six females, you know, not on salt water. Gobs of them fly by on the coast, but to actually settle and nest, you know, it's, yeah, a lot of those eiders, all the sea ducks for the most part, are a fraction of what they used to be.
Well, I don't want to open that whole can of worms. Actually, I'd love to, but we probably shouldn't. I'd like to know more about what happened to the spectacled eider, but so our listeners are going to want to know a little bit more about, you know, we were staring at back-to-back years of a nasty drought last year. We had enough carryover, partly from COVID. Mature ducks last year, we still had pretty good hunting everywhere, much better than the year prior in some places. And then we got all that snow that gave you cabin fever across, you know, the provinces, the prairies, Minnesota, the Dakotas, so much snow. It's just, it's only now just melted in some areas. How are we situated in the duck factory, Chris, overall? I was just in Alberta. It looked to me like there was water everywhere. Out around Edmonton, there was waterfowl everywhere, ducks and geese. All those crescent-faced blue-winged teal like Jim was talking about. It was so fun to see them. Just a treat. Cranes everywhere. Water everywhere. But the locals were telling me the lakes are still low. It melted too fast. This permafrost is gone, so it's sinking into the ground and evaporating at a rate that it shouldn't. So even though it looks like we have water, it might not be all hunky-dory. How are we situated for the duck factory this year?
Yeah, no, I mean, everyone's flying surveys right now. I actually had breakfast with a really good guy, really good friend of mine that's on the survey crew and picking his brain. But yeah, I'd say it's really sounded like a good, solid average year. You know, my buddy Carver here in North Dakota that I mentioned before, he's an ag researcher, and you know, one stat I didn't know about was, at least for North Dakota, is this was the second lowest soil moisture we ever had going into winter. And then keep in mind, it was that storm, it's like November 13th or whatever, you know, we instantly, boom, we went from 60s, temperatures in the 60s to 2 feet of snow, and it just blanketed everything perfectly. Like my wife's an organic farmer right now, and she's got a lot of spinach that overwintered because the ground never really froze. You know, she could be selling spinach right now, big, huge leaves of spinach.
What?
And it's impressive. And, you know, so one, we didn't freeze. I was really surprised with runoff this year. Seeing blowing bitches was actually rare. You could find it, but not like you'd expect, because we had 101.2 inches of snow here, second snowiest year ever. I mean, you think there would have been just torrents coming off, but you know, things just went right into the ground. And there's puddles out there, don't get me wrong. There's sheet water, a lot of these type one, type two wetlands, but not like you'd expect with that amount of snow. So I think it all balanced out where we're in a pretty good place, but it's not insane by any means. And I think Manitoba, I've been up to Manitoba and Saskatchewan a little bit, and they got some shot in the arms. They're in better shape than they have been for the last 8 years, but they got a long ways to go. And then Alberta, I'm really impressed. You know, granted, it sounds like you were quite a ways up north, but, you know, Alberta's been struggling as a duck production area for decades. You know, it's almost to the point, should we really be scratching our heads and almost writing southern Alberta off, you know, yeah, especially for pintails. So, yeah, good solid year. Now, let's see what happens. You know, our crews just found first canvasback nest last week. They just found their first blue-winged teal nest today during lunch. And, yeah, the season's off. I know there's geese on the Waikato Delta. I'd assume some of those high Arctic birds will be arriving here pretty soon.
Yeah, how exciting to hear about the first duck nest. Everyone listening, it's May 17th at 12:41 p.m. He's saying that, that's mountain time, but you get the idea. We're dead center of May, and the birds are starting to nest, so let's just look. We'll take that big shot in the arm of moisture, even if it's not the ongoing change that we hope to see. We'll for sure take it over what we've seen the last few years. And Chris, we really thank you for your time. Jim, you got any more questions? We all have about 20 questions, and we're definitely going to have you back on, Chris. But Jim,
yeah, anytime. No, I love talking waterfowl. It's pretty much what I think about 90% of the average day.
All right, Chris, my last question, and I promise I won't ask another one. What was your very first duck that you killed? How old were you? Where'd you kill? Give me your very first duck that you shot, that no one else shot at, that you got.
Yeah, Wood Duck, opening day 1987, Sherburne National Wildlife Refuge, just northwest of Minneapolis.
Okay.
Now, I tried a few times before that. I think I had 2 years under my belt at that point, but finally connected.
Henner Drake.
Drake, yep.
Nice.
He was three. I didn't select for it.
he was 3 years old, folks.
Yeah.
So you went to work for Delta in 2019. That's too bad, because I wanted to take credit for our 2020 story, the Indiana Jones and waterfowl story, you know, probably getting you that job. But I guess we can't. But when people met you after that story, did they expect you to look a little more like Harrison Ford? I mean, you're kind of close, but.
Yeah, I think he's got a lot more hair than me, even at his age. But no, it's fine. Now, Joe actually came and collected all that stuff when I was still in Nevada, and then, you know, just over the process, you know, it came out. Yeah, that was just like the Emperor story. Delta ran an Emperor story too, and you know, we wrote that before I even interviewed, and it ended up coming out like the first month I was here. So okay. It all takes time to interview, come up with good stories, get it through the publication process, you know.
Yeah, I think we're all waiting for a hero biologist in our ranks, even though they've always been quiet heroes. It was fun to have one that with such good stories to tell, for sure. Last real quick question. Give me a, because we do need to wrap this up. Give me a 3-sentence synopsis on where we're at with avian bird flu, and maybe even just a yes or no, whether you think it's going to affect the next season very much. Are we out of the
woods? I was surprised. I went up, like I said, I went up 2 weeks ago to do a retirement hunt, just me and my dogs. And I actually ran into a spot where I saw some birds, and the locals are telling me there is no hunting going on. But I'm also a scientist, and I know there's a paper that's either come out or is coming out that's really showing that the genetics of the wild waterfowl strains are very different than what we're seeing in the poultry production places. So when the strains are different like that, it's really suggesting that the poultry production is more of a biosecurity issue rather than the wild birds bringing it in. And boy, I sure hope, and we're lucky we could even bring birds back from Canada last year, and you had to only keep the feathered wing. And my daughter and I had our best two hunts of our lives last year. One was, you know, the king eiders, but the other was going up and enjoying the first year. You could shoot 8 white fronts a day, and boy, cleaning up 48 white fronts without bringing back all that fat and skin just brought tears to our eyes. Made cleaning a heck of a lot faster, but I sure hope we deal with it, you know, and it's still in effect. When I brought snow geese back 2 weeks ago, just a wing, no fat, no skin, so... Hopefully we can get some people working on that so we can bring back that juicy fat this fall.
That's gold. That's waterfowl gold, that fat and that skin, that's for sure. Well, we sure appreciate your time. You got me a little bit inspired to have a look at decoy carving, especially with my little kids. I know they would lose their minds over it. And you made me definitely want to see what a real live goose colony is like one day, even without a, I mean, Jim has those golf courses out in Cleveland. That's kind of the same, but a real life goose colony without a gun in hand, man, that would be something else to experience. So thanks for your time today, Mr. Nikolai, and we'll have you on again soon. I think everyone out there listening could get a little bit fired up about his life story and you know, showing that you follow your passion and your dreams can come true. And as my daddy said, when I was 8 years old, you know, you play your cards right and someone will pay you to do what you'd rather be doing anyway. I think Chris Nikolai is about as much proof of that as anyone on earth. So until next time, everyone, thanks for listening. And please go to wildfowlmag.com for more killer content or to submit band tales. And we appreciate you listening.